This is All of It. I'm Kusha Navadar in for Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your Thursday with us. I'm so glad you're here. Here's what we've got on today's show. Toriano Gordon is here. He's the chef behind the Bay Area restaurant Vegan Mob, and he's going to join me to discuss his new cookbook, which is Soul Food Without Animal-Based Ingredients. Really interesting. Then we'll speak with local rapper Cakes Dakilla, who is touring the world right now in support of his new album, Black Sheep. And then we're going to talk with the person behind the new oral history project titled Transgenerational, Trans Lives Across Time. That's all coming up, so let's get things started with Kevin Baker, the author of The New York Game, Baseball, and the Rise of a New City. It's opening day, which means every team in Major League Baseball is kicking off their 2024 season, except the Mets. Bad weather means they're playing tomorrow. Baseball is America's pastime, but here's something I just learned. The modern version of the game is actually very local. About 200 years ago, New Yorkers were playing a game that was the foundation of what we know as baseball today. This city is where baseball got its rules. We're talking where we got the diamond, the curveball, stealing first base. It's where Tammany Hall controlled access to fields, where people cooked up plans to throw the 1919 World Series, and where Babe Ruth swung magic to resurrect faith in the game. There's a lot to uncover with this city in baseball. And a new book does that. It lays out this history from the game's origins until the end of World War II. It's about baseball in New York, but it's also about baseball and New York, a history of both and how they're intertwined. Think more sociology, less sabermetrics. It's titled The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. And the author, Kevin Baker, joins me in studio. Kevin, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Kusha. Very nice to be back.
Wonderful to have you. You start in the book saying that it's not entirely clear where the first modern day baseball game was played. And of course, games with bats and balls, they date back centuries. Yes. But you say that one thing is clear. Abner Doubleday had nothing to do with it. Talk about that. Who was he?
Yeah, I mean, as David Block makes clear in Baseball Before We Knew It, you know, there's evidence of bat and ball games being played in ancient Egypt. We started playing bat and ball games pretty much since we dropped out of the trees and got in the savannah, you know, and everybody claims to be the place where baseball started from Prague to Pittsfield, Mass. But the one thing that's clear is Abner Doubleday had nothing to do with it. And this kind of plays into what I'm writing about here, about how New York was the real origin of what we think of as baseball today, but we have long refused to admit it.
Yeah, you make an emphatic case that baseball is a New York City game. I'm assuming, like, blowback from anyone about that claim?
Not yet. I mean, Doubleday, you know, and it's a riot because Doubleday was sort of the Forrest Gump of the 19th century. He was on hand when anything and everything happened. He was almost hit by the first shot of the Civil War. Mm. He aimed the first shot back at the Confederacy. He commanded an all-black regiment of troops at one point, held the line at Gettysburg, went back to Gettysburg with Lincoln for the Gettysburg Address, went to seances with Mrs. Lincoln at the White House, had the franchise for the first cable car company in San Francisco, and was a member of Madame Blavatsky's, a prominent member of Madame Blavatsky's Theosophist Society.
But did not make baseball.
But he did not invent baseball. It seems to have come, you know, around the turn of the century, about 1905, you know, A.J. Spaulding of, Albert Spaulding of, sporting goods fame, hired this commission to look into who started baseball because he didn't want to have the American game having come from England, where many of its antecedents were indeed played. But he didn't want that to be admitted. So they came up, they got a letter from this this kind of bizarre individual saying he remembered when Abner Doubleday first laid out the game on the banks of the Glimmerglass up next to Cooperstown, New York. And it seems that they went with this. You know, even one of the members of the commission, a guy named A.G. Mills, admitted that he didn't think Doubleday had invented it. He said, you know, and he was Doubleday's best friend for 20 years. Oh. And he admitted that Doubleday never mentioned the game to him. You know, and the thing with Mills is he was president of the National League. Doubleday somehow never said, you know that thing you're president of? I invented it. Never came up.
And you're saying that New York City is really where a lot of our modern rules kind of emerge from.
Exactly. You know, yeah. And Mills made it clear that what he was, well, the proud thing was it was such a charming, wonderful village, Cooperstown. Mm. And it is. It's a great, the Hall of Fame is great. But they wanted to keep it out of the big, multi-ethnic, corrupt city, which they thought of as New York.
And when you say it, do you mean the sport or the Hall of Fame? What are you talking
they
about?
They wanted to keep the sport out of it. They wanted to keep the origins of baseball out of it. But it's really New York. You couldn't, you know, to get 18 people together for a game, very hard to do with American farm life.
Well, let's
how big those farms were.
Yeah, let's dig into that, because now you're talking about why New York City, kind of, right? So before we get into the nuts and bolts of the history, like more broadly, what is it about New York City that transformed baseball from a game into a business? You mentioned getting 18 people collected in one place, kind of tough to do in farmlands. Like, what else was there to that?
Right, a lot of open lot as the city, you know, boomed up Manhattan. A lot of lots there. Later, a lot of lots in Brooklyn, in Hoboken, where maybe the first game we would think of as baseball was played in 1845, maybe not. You know, and a lot of people around. And it was also became quickly a thing where people of almost all ethnic groups, people of almost all classes could go and meet and play and fight, you know, and you know, get along on the field. So it very much reflected the city and America in that sense.
Knickerbocker, I think, is an important element to this. How did the Knickerbocker rules change over time? And what was going on in New York City, the politics, their current events that would influence the rules?
Yeah, the Knickerbockers, the Knickerbocker Ball Club, which was, you know, they came up with a later, you know, historical myth, a foundation myth of them, that they went over to Hoboken one day with their club of gentlemen and played a mysterious club called the New York Nine and lost 23-1. I read that first when I was 8 years old, and I didn't believe it then. How did they lose 23-1 to, you know, when they invented the sport? And in fact, they were just one of a bunch of clubs around the New York area at the time. But they were the ones who really consolidated the rules. They wrote them all down. They made them into kind of the modern game. And you know, there was a there were a number of competitors. There were all kinds of different versions. The big competitors at the time were the Philadelphia game, and the you know, which you played with a Dalil, you know, just kind of a small bat. You can imagine how that went over in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure.
Give me the Dalil. and you had the Massachusetts game, which was basically this sort of wild running game. Mm-hmm. And you hit or soaked the runners with the ball to get them out. And you could hit the ball backwards. There was no fair or foul territory. And it sounds like absolute fun, but I don't know how you put a stadium around that. It sounds like a Looney Tunes cartoon more than anything else.
When you had mentioned before that one of the special elements of New York City was that there were a lot of different ethnic groups who could all come together, that doesn't sound like how it always was down the road. When did that change?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. You know, I say almost because that's also part of the tragedy of the game and part of the tragedy of the country. There were early on constant attempts to exclude people of color, to exclude black, you know, to exclude African Americans and Hispanics mostly from the sport. Before 1884, you still had 55 known players of color playing in the minors or the majors. Again, despite taking tremendous abuse, but after that, they really drew the color line. You know, completely, and you did not have another known player of color until Jackie Robinson is signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers.
What
right
happened
after
in 1884?
That was when they really, at the insistence of one of the star players of the time, a guy named Cap Anson, they really insisted, no, we can't be playing with black players. And this was, you know, the part of the weirdness and horribleness of racism. Because these players, the black players in the game, were very good. They were undoubtedly, you know, they were great, but talent wasn't enough. And that's reflected in racism throughout America. Not a question of talent, not a question of can you do the job, a question of we don't want to associate with you no matter what. And that's, you know, it's kind of cast as, you know, as Ms. Wilkinson writes in that, you know, her wonderful book there, you know. Mm-hmm. So this was the sort of thing that was kind of imposed on the game, and that was a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. And nonetheless, there were great Hispanic and Black teams in New York and elsewhere in the segregated days of the game.
One of the things I found fascinating on that topic was the story of Alex Pompez and how he came to Harlem and built a team called the Cuban Stars,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
That story. That was super interesting.
And later the New York Cubans. Yeah, very interesting guy. Came up here with nothing. Started a policy bank. It's a great bio of him by Adrian Burgos, by the way. But started a policy bank in Harlem, but his real love was baseball. And so he puts together this great kind of originally Cuban, later kind of all Hispanic all-star team, later Black as well as Hispanic. You know, he even builds his own park, the Dyckman Oval up in upper Manhattan. You know, has lights before major league teams. One day, Dutch Schultz comes in, or Dutch Schultz's goons come in and tell him, you're now working for Dutch Schultz, this leading murderous gangster. And then a little after that, Tom Dewey's assistant DAs come in and say, we want you to testify against Dutch Schultz. So Pompez does the only logical thing. He takes it on the lam, goes down to Mexico City. You know, a couple years later, they find him, drag him back. But by this point, Schultz is dead and, you know, his ballpark's gone. But he then turns the Cubans into the only Negro League team that became a minor league team of one of the white major leagues. And that's the New York Giants. He's, you know, and he produces, helps produce all these great Black and Hispanic stars for the Giants. People like, he helps sign Willie Mays, signs guys like Orlando Cepeda, Juan Marichal, the Alou brothers. So he transforms the game and ends up eventually in the Hall of Fame. Wow. So, but, you know, really interesting way in which he kind of made do.
One of the things that comes out in this book that you're kind of alluding to right now is the awesome cast of characters. And by awesome, I mean huge cast of characters.
Thanks.
There. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people that you were learning new things about or introduced to. And we actually have a caller who called in with a question about this. So
right,
David
great.
In Brooklyn.
Great.
Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, David.
Hey, how are you? First off, let me just say that this is one hell of a book, and it should be on the short list of best nonfiction books of the year. But going back to the cast of characters, Kevin, in your doing research, certain people really stood out. I mean, obviously, there's Ruth and Mathewson, and you just mentioned Pompez. But is there one person who you, if you had an opportunity to have a beer with, that would be that person?
You know, first of all, from your lips to God's ears, David, thanks very much. You know, yeah, that's a good question. There are so many terrific people in the book, a lot of enigmatic characters. I wouldn't dare have a beer with Ruth because he'd probably drink me under the table. Christy Mathewson is a really intriguing guy. First real superstar in baseball, first real superstar, therefore, in American sports. Very intriguing guy. Came in as kind of a goody-goody in the sports. You know, he would say things like, a man who would betray his wife might betray his country, too. You know, and he was so well looked upon. He's actually, his image is in a stained glass window at St. John the Divine's Cathedral to this day. But he very quickly learned how to get along with his teammates and to become, you know, just be worshipped by them. I mean, he comes in, they can't stand this guy. He was a little bow-legged. He was, you know, he had a kind of a high voice, and they thought he was a jerk. And pretty soon, they just love him. And he would go and gamble with them. He would go and fight with them on the field, you know. So, and that becomes a theme throughout. New York stars who learn to adjust to their teammates, to adjust to the game, to become one of the guys. And it keeps defining them. You know, it's like what Derek Jeter is able to do, Alex Rodriguez, unfortunately, was not. Mm. But it kind of defines how players' times are going to be in New York, and it was fascinating to see that.
And you see that cult of personality, maybe, or that interest in developing the personality and people having affinity to it, kind of cutting through time. It's a theme that you see over and over again.
Yeah,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, very much.
So we're talking with, oh, first of all, David from Brooklyn, thank you very much for that wonderful question. We're talking with Kevin Baker, the author of The New York Game: Baseball and the Rise of a New York City, and the Rise of a New City. Sorry, mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into politics and baseball. And Tammany Hall, stick with us. We'll be right back. This is All of It from WNYC. I'm Kusha Navidar, and we're talking to Kevin Baker, the author of The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. It's about how baseball and New York are intertwined, and actually the game kind of came from here in the modern way we know it today. We've been getting some calls, so I want to take one quick one from Billy in East Orange. Hi, Billy. Welcome to the show.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi.
We can
What's
you
your
well.
Story?
Okay, good. All right. My grandfather, Charles Cerny, was on the Brooklyn Bushwicks at the same time, played the Cuban All-Stars. They played at Dexter Park.
Oh, yeah.
And my grandfather, for reasons I'm not sure, was an ace under the lights. He was 9-1 in 1932. He was their nighttime light pitcher.
Wow, Billy, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Grandfather pitched against the Cuban Stars, which we just talked about, Kevin, before the break.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny, we did not explicitly open the phones for this segment, and it's wonderful that folks have such an affinity with this history and what you've written, Kevin, that they want to call in. So,
Thanks. Hey,
live show, let's open up the phones. If you have a question about baseball history, give us a call or text us, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We really do appreciate these calls. Kevin, I want to get to politics and baseball.
Yeah.
Huge
yeah.
part of the book. One of the things that really surprised me about reading the book is how baseball is tied into the political establishment of the time, like Tammany Hall. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, very much so. First of all, a quick thing about Dexter Park, which was one of these kind of lesser parks that, you know, unfortunately, people of color were forced to play in Brooklyn, but had a great sign in it saying something like, don't blame the umpire. Maybe it's your eyes. Go see this, you know, optometrist thing. So this, but yeah, the game was early on very much tied in with Tammany Hall, which kind of controlled all entertainment in the city. And Tammany at the time, like the whole political culture of New York was very corrupt. It was also tied in with crime, with organized crime. And so, you know, if you didn't do what Tammany wanted you to, they might run a street through your ballpark, which happened to at least two early ballparks, the first Polo Grounds and Hilltop Park up where the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital is today.
And quickly, what years are we talking about here?
Oh, the original one, the Polo Grounds, was in the 1880s, late 1880s. It was originally kind of on the northeast end of Central Park. And then, you know, the one up in Washington Heights, they terminated it around 1913. So this was, you know, they controlled things. They wanted things their way. You had to play ball with Tammany. Mm. You know, the founder of the American League, Ban Johnson, brings in this team that becomes the Highlanders and then the Yankees. He's only allowed to bring it in if he allows these Tammany characters to own it. Completely corrupt people. Big Bill Devery, this completely corrupt police chief. Frank Farrell, the biggest gambler in the country probably at this point. You know, and even later on, you have guys like Jacob Rupert, who was a Tammany congressman for four terms to bring in the German vote. He owns the Yankees, and he starts to move away from Tammany. Mm. He kind of starts corporatizing baseball. But for a long time, all these guys were very close to Tammany Hall, to politics. And it really, you know, it helped corrupt the game in really bad ways.
So, you know, there's this in the book, The Power Broker by Robert Caro. Mm-hmm. He writes that in the chapter about the city before Robert Moses, he wrote, quote, "The provision for active sports was so inadequate that although Tammany reserved permits for the city's 162 baseball diamonds. Yeah. Negro teams from politically powerless Harlem seldom got one. Yeah. There were still 942 teams with permits waiting to use the diamonds on a typical Sunday. So we've got 162 open spaces, 942 people that want to play, right. Basically, right?
And that you know, as Mr. Carroll points out, that speaks to how, you know, what an inveterate racist Robert Moses was in terms of putting black people at the end of the line. It also speaks, though, to, you know, how there were fewer, you know, many fewer playgrounds. You know, little boys were only allowed to play baseball in Central Park if they had a certificate of good conduct and written permission from their school principal. Adults weren't allowed to play baseball in Central Park till the 1920s. So, you know, play was very restricted in many ways.
We're getting some texts with people with specific questions for you. Yeah, so one text that I think is interesting here. Could he, Kevin, speak more on how style of pitching has changed? Do you have any sense of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that also evolved really in New York. A guy named Candy Cummings kind of invented the curveball. Originally, you know, you were supposed to pitch the ball the way the batter wanted it. And, you know, you were supposed to throw it underhand. Eventually, we went to overhand. We went to sidearm pitching. We went to the curveball. Candy Cummings threw the curveball against the Harvard team and was denounced by the president of Harvard, Charles Elliott. Thought it was very un-cricket, you know. But this is what, you know, really changed. And it's interesting. One of the, you know, many comparisons, the game then, the game now. You know, everybody throws harder now. Mm. Probably true. On the other hand, for years, you were up there without a helmet, without any kind of the body armor players have now. And this was, you know, this was dangerous. And you actually had a player, the only player to die on a major league field was killed at the Polo Grounds in 1920 by a pitched ball.
Oh, wow.
So a submarine delivery.
Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. Were you going to say at the end?
A submarine delivery of a pitcher, you know, named Carl Mays, who threw the submarine pitch that was very hard to pick up. And it hit this wonderful shortstop for the Indians named Ray Chapman in the head and you know, killed him.
Since we're talking about not just the style of game, but we're kind of encroaching into rules of the game, we have a caller who has a question about that. Patrick from Newport, Rhode Island. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, Kevin. Definitely going to get this book for my dad, Father's Day. It seems like it's going to be a great read.
Thanks.
But my question was, you know, you've studied the past rules of all these different versions of the game of baseball. Is there any rule in particular that you think would be cool if it was reinstated in today's game?
You know, the one thing I hate about the new rule changes, and they were made to speed up the game, and I think in some ways they do that. I hate what we call the Manfred man, you know, the guy they put on second base in extra innings. I love the kind of weirdness of a long extra inning game. And there aren't a lot of extra inning games. They don't last very – I think this was done mostly to kind of fit baseball more into a TV-friendly package of a certain, you know, numbers, a predictable amount of time. And I think that's a shame. So I would get rid of that. Mm. In general, you know – what I wish is baseball would go back to kind of more of an organic culture. Mm. Fewer rules, more, you know, for instance, like hit to the, you know, you want the shift off, don't have a rule against the shift, hit to the opposite field or bunt to the opposite field. You know, it used to be pitchers pitch to contact and pitch quickly to keep the fielders more involved in the game. I wish baseball would get back to changing its culture more than the rules, really.
So first, Kevin, thank you for that call. I forget the name
Patrick.
Of the last part. Patrick, thank you. Patrick, thank you for that call. Kevin, since you're talking about how to change the game, you're some of the things you're discussing are actually about commercialization.
Yes.
And I think gambling is an interesting element of that commercialization, especially talking about Tammany Hall like we were before. There's this story about the 1919 World Series that I think encapsulates gambling and New York City and baseball. Can you share that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, this is the dangerous territory baseball is in now because they basically invited the devil back into the room. The world's, you know, gambling was a huge part of the game. as John Thorne, you know, delineates very well in his typically great baseball historical writings. But gambling was a huge part of making the game commercial and professional, but it got increasingly out of hand. And as players, you know, could not make the money they should have made, thanks to the reserve clause, they started throwing games. And they usually these were meaningless games at the end of the year. But it got to the point where they actually conspired. Players on the Chicago White Sox conspired to throw the 1919 World Series. Mm-hmm. And they plotted this at the Ansonia Hotel, then a popular hotel for ball players, the same apartment building on the Upper West Side. And they went and connived with Arnold Rothstein, the the big gambler, big financier of organized crime in New York, and to give you an idea of how in bed baseball was with this sort of corruption, Rothstein had previously been a co-owner in a Herald Square pool hall with John McGraw, the great owner, the great manager of the New York Giants, and again. How much this goes into the establishment, you know, they paid off every month to the New York Police Department, as all pool hall owners did. So you can see this kind of circuit of corruption that was just leading inevitably to some kind of implosion. Mm. And it came with the World Series fix, and baseball cleaned up its act. They hired this very erratic, commissioner, this very erratic judge, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, to be commissioner. He really banned gambling in the game. Mm. And you had Babe Ruth come along, and he kind of saved the sport, this larger-than-life character.
Icon.
Yeah, New York City icon. He could do everything, you know. So here we are now, you know, over 100 years later, and the guy baseball is looking to save the sport maybe involved is Shohei Ohtani, maybe involved in a gambling scandal himself. And if so, baseball has just really brought this on. All professional sports have brought this on by really embracing the revenue dollars from gambling. Mm. You know, and they were riding for a fall with this.
And it's another, you know, we were talking about the personalities of players being an affinity throughout the years, that theme. Here's another theme, the commercialization, and that in New York City really taking a hold. We've got
exactly.
Time for one more quick call. Charlie in South Orange. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. A great book, Kevin, a very readable history. But I'd like to switch from the past to the future.
Okay.
So baseball is not the national pastime now,
yeah.
Right? Football is by far the most popular sport. Soccer is becoming more popular, and I think arguably more children are playing soccer than baseball. So I'm curious, what do you see as the future of baseball as a national sport? What does it need to maintain or even regain its popularity?
Great question, Charlie. Thanks very much. It's well, first of all, for soccer, you know, to steal a phrase about communism, in America, soccer is the sport of the future, and it always will be. But football is, I have to admit, the American sport right now. Mm. Basketball may pass baseball as well, they will have their own innate problems. You know, in the case of football, with catastrophic injuries, brain damage. Basketball, again, limits the physical type who can play it. You got to be big, you know. Baseball, I hope, will make a comeback. And I think it can make a comeback. I think it's intrinsically the most interesting of games. It's a great individual game in the middle of a team game, which is pretty rare. And I think it'll appeal to all kinds of people and can be played by all kinds of people. You know, you have guys like Jose Altuve, this you know, guy much too short or small for other sports, you know, who's a baseball MVP. So I think this is the potential baseball has to get back to it. I think the corporate entity now known as MLB has to really get on the stick and promote the game much more, and particularly much more in cities. Mm. You know, I see diamonds all the time in Riverside Park, elsewhere in the city, that are empty. you know, people should be, the Major League Baseball should have got kids out there playing.
And as we look to the future, what better way than to understand its history and its past than through this book? We've been talking to Kevin Baker. The book is The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City, out now. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.